Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
This is News Talk.
This is Alive and Kicking, and you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up, fake news is something that we hear bandied about a lot, but it's rife in the world of health news. So we'll be meeting with Laura Dowling. She's also known as the Fabulous Pharmacist. It's her social handle and also her general way of being. And she'll talk about how you can find out the right information and check you're not being misled when it comes to your health. A photo stopped me in my tracks this week of Trudy Hayes. She is the founder of the Raven app that brings beauty services to people in their homes. But it was born when she spent multiple months and years in hospital herself and realised the value of your appearance. And that's where it was founded. I saw a photograph of her with her scars for a famous photographer online as part of his exhibition. And she'll be here to tell her story. And also, we hear a lot about young people and anxiety. Well, a little bit later, we're going to be joined by Jennifer Ryan. She's the lady behind superme.ie. And she feels the term is overused and wants to focus on resilience for young people. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, I did mention that I went to a spa day last week. And I know that makes me sound most privileged. I was grateful for it. But they didn't have magazines lying around the place. You kind of asked for them. They were there if you needed them. But because they weren't there and I had no book and I didn't have my phone that was in my locker, I found it really difficult to just sit. And I mean, this was a beautifully designed spa. There were areas where they had a fake fire going on. There was an area outside, a little cabana that you could have rugs over your knees. There was a pool. There was all the different thermal suites. And yet I found myself yearning for something to focus on other than just sit. So this week, with that in mind, I have tried to work on that because I think it comes from the phones. So if I'm having my breakfast or my lunch, I just leave the phone away and I just sit there with my own self. It's not as funny as flicking through other people's Insta stories, I'd have to say, but that's something that I have been working on. And a podcast that struck me this week was an interview that Fern Cotton did for her series The Happy Place, and it's with Katie Piper. And you'll remember that a number of years ago she was the victim of an acid attack from an ex-partner, and since then she has set up the Katie Piper Foundation and just done amazing work and used it to just fortify herself. But it was when she was talking about being in hospital and so many people have said, and to my shame, after listening to her, I've said it myself, how sad it was that she lost so much of her looks, because she had been a part-time model. And that's something that you always think about with that attack, that, you know, part of her looks were taken. But she said, when you wake up in a hospital bed and you've lost all of your belongings and you can't see properly, you can't hear properly, she was being fed by a peg, she said, then none of that matters. It's not what you look like. It's the fact that you can hear, that you can see, that you can eat, are privileges that we don't put enough weight into. And that really stopped me in my tracks this week. And as I mentioned earlier, Trudy Hayes is a lady who can vouch for all of that. And we'll hear her incredible story a little bit later on. You can text the show 53106 or you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. So Laura Dowling is the Fabulous Pharmacist online and in person with over 15 years experience as a pharmacist. She's also a mum of three who has a very holistic view of health, that we should start with our lifestyle, our diet, the exercise we're having before we even knock on the door or work alongside her and her fellow drug dealers, as she called them online this week. Laura, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you're here today to talk about fake news, in a way, because it's a big buzzword in the minute at the moment, and how we are influenced by false information. And it's massive in the world of healthcare.
It's huge and it's very scary because there's so much available, so much information available online, and so many people that people can follow online that aren't necessarily giving good advice and the correct advice. So I suppose it would be a little bit of a bugbear of mine.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes people say things like, you know, there's no smoke without fire, or you can't unsee something. So even if you read a report that then gets discredited, it comes back time and time and time again. These things just don't go away.
Well, absolutely. Sure, it's like the original MMR scare. It just keeps coming back. It has been proven without doubt that it was completely false and misleading.
This was the report by that MMR was linked to autism.
Absolutely.
In some way.
Yes, and completely refuted by many, many clinicians over the years, still is, but there is still a campaign out there that is linking the MMR to autism, and it's just very, very scary. And even more recently, I posted online about the flu vaccine and how important it is to get it. The HSE are sending out guidelines on how to get it. And I saw some posts come up about, instead of taking the flu jab, why not take this homeopathy remedy, which is just ludicrous, you know. So I think it's about being careful about who you follow online. Follow whomever you want, but be careful who you listen to and get advice from.
There was a recent report about HRT, and I want to talk to you a little bit about statistics and headline stats that can really scare people, but you need to delve further and read the small print below.
You absolutely do, because statistical significance does not always translate to clinical significance. And I think that's really, really important to understand that. That report that was published by The Lancet, you know, it was a report that was done over 20 years of a study of over 100,000 women. It's actually quite hard to even understand it myself, and I would be able to understand clinical trials and data. Professor Michael Baum, who is a leading breast cancer expert, actually called the report irresponsible. It didn't actually give a huge amount of information that we don't already know about how HRT can increase breast cancer very, very slightly. But we need to take an overall view of this. It's lifestyle factors that can influence it much more. 20% of it can be linked to obesity, drinking alcohol, lack of physical exercise, lack of fibre intake as well, smoking. So HRT is way, way down the list at 2% when you consider stats just for bare baseline stats. And even at that, a lot of those reports that The Lancet was commenting on and that drew its information from were using HRT therapies that are outdated now. We do use body identical progesterones now. Very few clinicians are prescribing the older progesterones that would have been linked to the HRT. And also, if you delve even further, it's, you know, estrogen only HRT, which is used for women that no longer have a uterus. The significance of that was very, very, very slight. It was combination therapies of estrogen and progesterone that were seen to be causing the problem. And even at that, it's the progesterone, the older use progesterone, as opposed to the ones that are used nowadays.
God, sometimes it's hard to be a woman.
Oh, listen, it so is. And it's like, is there a vendetta about it as well? Because HRT is really, really important. It has proven time and time again to, change incredibly the lives of women that are suffering with the menopausal symptoms, but also increase their longevity because it protects against heart disease and cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, not to mention dementia and depression. So I would take being protected against those things any day.
Because the headline read that the risk of breast cancer has doubled, but it doubled from
1% to 2%.
1% to 2%.
Yeah, so it's very, very slight. So, you know, if you looked at the statistics, it showed, so if you take breast cancer, a woman being tracked for breast cancer over a 20-year period over the age of 50, the chances of her getting it would be 6.8%. If she was on HRT for 5 years, after the 20 years, then she's checked and it's 8.8%. So that's an increase of 2%. So we need to look at the statistics and really delve into them before we say, you know, something is clinically significant. And it also goes, it's like the fat free or the free, what's the only 1% fat, or only when you flip it, it's what's the 99% that's in it as well, then, you know, that way. It's like looking at them and looking at them properly. But as I said, it can be hard for someone even like me. Professor Michael Baum said himself it was difficult for him to try and interpret those results too. So how can the lay people that are vulnerable, that need help, that see these headlines and get very scared by them, How are they supposed to interpret them?
Because you are just flicking through your phone. And like I said, you don't really take the time to delve in. But really what you've taken away from it is there's risks with HRT. I don't know if that's for me. And that's what you take away from it.
I know. And it's scaremongering as well. And it's unnecessary scaremongering. I think if a woman has menopausal symptoms and she is concerned, she needs to get one-to-one care. She needs to go to her GP. She needs to get supported. She needs to go to a GP who's interested in menopause too. And there are many of them out there. But she needs to get the proper help and the information, that the pros and the cons, but the benefits much outweigh the risks, I think.
What about then clinical trials that are set up for marketing purposes? Because again, it's down to percentages and headlines and all these figures that are bandied around. But we don't really know who commissioned the study in the first place and whether or not they really have your best interests or the bottom line at heart.
Yeah, I think you need to see who's actually commissioned the study in the first place. Do they have any link to the people that are selling the product that's being clinically trialled, whether it be a drug, whether it be a vitamin supplement? I think you need to look at the size of the study as well. You know, the gold standard of studies is randomised clinical trials. It's triple blind, so neither the person that's taking the drug or the product knows what it is, neither does the clinician, and neither does the person that's evaluating the response. So you need to take the whole view. And then also people should be there should be a disclaimer at the end of it if there was any interest or any self-interest in the clinical trial. You need to watch out for that too.
And we are getting better at that. I mean, I think I've seen Cheryl Cole be outed for wearing false lashes when she's advertising mascara. And is that the same then in healthcare? Are we starting to talk a bit more widely? I mean, I remember in recent years, so much was made about probiotic drinks and Elkelzii Immunitas was thrown around, and we were all like, oh yes, I need some of that. Whereas, how factual is this information really?
I think we need to really, I think probiotics themselves, they can be of some benefit. I think we have much more to do in terms of clinical trials and learning about all that area, because we're only just learning about gut microbiome and how important it is as well. But I think that it's really important to, as you say yourself, look and see who's marketing these products. Why are they marketing the products? Is there the clinically backed evidence to say that these products are good? I would always recommend that people look at the resources that are available, that are there, that are free of charge to look at. So the HSE website is fantastic. It's a real resource of up-to-date information. And they get all their information from the WHO, from the NHS as well. The NHS website is free to look at too. It has lots of information too. Just maybe don't get mixed up between, sometimes there might be healthcare differences in Ireland versus the UK. For instance, even with the flu vaccine, they're giving a nasal spray flu vaccine to children over in the UK, and they're recommending that. We're not there yet in Ireland, so just to make sure that you know, if you do go onto the HSE website and are comparing us to the NHS, that you're careful there too. The NICE guidelines are always good to look at too. They are, you know, the gold standard of what clinicians and pharmacists would look at in terms of how we look after and deal with our patients.
What about the Lancet then? That's something I always hear. And yeah, is that something that carries weight?
The Lancet is something that carries weight. It was the one that published that HRT study. So, and it has got a bit of a backlash from clinicians as a result of it. But yes, it is. The British Medical Journal also is a good one as well. Nature is a good one too. But those publications, though, they're more directed to clinicians and people with a scientific background. So although lay people may be able to read them, they maybe find it difficult to interpret them as well. So I think sometimes just going with the regular, the HSE, the NHS, the NICE guidelines, it kind of makes it a little bit easier for them to understand. But certainly, like, I mean, by all means, they could try it out.
So it is great that we have all these online resources, yeah, as you say, and social media can be a great thing, particularly mm-hmm. for people talking about their illness, talking about their experience and sharing health stories. But also, there are a lot of influencers, as you mentioned earlier, who are recommending how to treat certain ills that aren't necessarily experienced enough to do so.
Yeah, and I think you need to be really careful about that, because, and there are people with hundreds of thousands of followers that, if they say something online and some of their followers believe, and that can be very, very dangerous. So I think you need to be really, really careful about who you listened to online. Check their credentials. Make sure they seem like they're speaking the truth. You know, if you see someone that it sounds a little bit dodgy, it generally is dodgy. You need to be really careful. You need to check it out. You need to, and online shouldn't replace going to your own doctor and pharmacist either. I'm there to give healthcare advice and that to the general public, and I like to promote things that the HSE are promoting too. So for instance, just like I said, the flu vaccine, it's National Breastfeeding Week next week, so I'll be talking a little bit about that. I tend to go in line with what our national guidelines are saying. If people are coming out with wacky stuff, you need to be really, really careful and you need to get the proper advice. So go in and have a chat with your pharmacist face to face. Go in and talk to your GP face to face. Don't ever use online as a way that's your therapy. You know, you need to actually see someone as proper. That's what a physician is called. They see you physically.
Is there a place for anecdotal evidence, though? Do you have more people coming to you saying, will mint tea help this? Or, you know, and as I said in the introduction, you do have a holistic view about health. You're not going to instantly be reaching down
for
a bottle of pills.
No, that's very true. There, anecdotal evidence does have a place in medicine. Yes, it does. And there isn't going to be a randomised controlled trial on whether or not mint tea helps. Because, first of all, mint tea is widely available. No one owns that molecule, so no one's going to make money off a randomized control trial with that. But certainly a lot of people would find mint tea can help with tummy upsets and, you know, a little bit of cramping and things like that. So certainly anecdotal evidence is there, and it should be, you know, it can be, you can listen to someone who says that they have tried something, they find that it works, but you need to always have the back of your mind saying, is this evidence-based medicine? Is my doctor or GP or pharmacist saying this too? You know, what are online doctors or online pharmacists or people that are actually talking about healthcare in general? What do they think about these kind of things? It's very important to, you know, get the real information, because it's quite scary. Sometimes I do stay awake at night wondering, you know, goodness, can people be really influenced by these people and how dangerous it can be when they are?
Well, if you're looking for no nonsense, no wacky advice, you can follow her online. She's the fabulous pharmacist, Laura Dowling. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, I meet Jennifer Ryan from superme.ie. She's a child psychologist who works in the area of bullying, and she says we need to focus on resilience in young people.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
So anxiety in young people is on the rise. It's something we hear all the time. But what can we actually do about it, young people themselves and their loved ones? When joining me now is resilience and empowerment specialist Jennifer Ryan from superme.ie. And SuperMe really deal with these programmes for children affected by bullying. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning.
So tell me a little bit about why we're hearing more about anxiety in young people. Is it because it's reported more, diagnosed more, or is it about more?
I've a bugbear about this already because I think the word anxiety is being overused. So I've got children as young as 9 coming into my room saying, I have anxiety. Yet when I actually break it down, I say, okay, well, what are we anxious about? And I remove the word anxiety completely and I say, what are we worried about? What are our worries? Because ultimately that's what anxiety is. It's that sense that something is bothering us, the feeling of unsafety maybe, something isn't quite right, we want to do something better. So these children are coming to me saying they have anxiety, and then when I break it down and I say, well, what are we worried about? What are our worries? They kind of look at me and go, well, I'm not really worried about anything, I don't really know. So it's the word anxiety has just been put onto everything, and then young people are attaching to it.
Yeah.
And now I'm not, I don't want to overgeneralize. I think there's a lot of, there is, and I have seen them, a lot of young people out there genuinely suffering with generalised anxiety, which is a set of distinct symptoms over a 6-month period in order for us to call it that. But in general terms, a lot of these children don't have anxiety.
Yeah, because having worries or being anxious about certain things in our life is normal.
Absolutely. And we have to really, I always stress this, anxiety is normal. So when a young person first comes to me and with anxiety, I say, I've anxiety too at the moment. And they kind of look at me and go, what do you mean? And I said, well, I'm really anxious that I'm going to do a good job here. I'm really anxious I'm going to help you. So I want to make sure so that's going to help me work harder. That's going to help me tune into you really well. So we need to kind of normalize that anxiety, the sense of anxiety, is a healthy and normal reaction. It keeps us safe. It's fight and flight stuff.
But it's how you handle these worries and the effect you let them have on your body and your life.
Exactly.
That's the difference.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of our young people are living in almost this permanent state of fight and flight. So everything has this fear factor. I had a lovely example recently. I was driving and there was pedestrian lights and there was a young person crossing the road. Now, they had the green light to cross. I had the red light and I was slowing down to a stop. And she saw the car and she stopped in her tracks. She took two steps back and I actually visually saw her go, and then she kept walking. And that is exactly what we do. We are in a situation where we question, is this safe? Is this not safe? We remove ourselves from it momentarily, either by just taking a second in our own heads or by physically stepping back. And then we take a big deep breath and we go, do you know what? This is safe. This isn't a threat to us. And we keep going. But this is where our young people are getting stuck. They're not grounding themselves saying, we are safe. This is okay. So we don't do great in a maths test. We're going to do better the next time. Instead of this panic, as you say, the physicality of it, we need to teach them to ground themselves into this idea that it's okay. This is safe.
So what's causing it then? What's causing this disconnect with our worries and how we handle it? What's missing?
Oh, I think there's a load of factors going on. I think there's, firstly, it's a really difficult time. We've all been there. We've all gone through this growing up stage. Early adolescence, they say 10 to 13, 10 to 14. It's a difficult stage. They're trying, now I'm picking on that age group at the moment. I'm seeing younger, I'm seeing older. But the 10 to 13 age group, just for the moment to talk about, it's that period of, we talk about going from a child in the family to a person in the world. And it's a lovely phrase when we look at it like that. They should be cosseted by the family still at this stage, where they are beginning to then develop their independence from the safety of that. Social media gets blamed for an awful lot of stuff. It is a factor here because these children at the age of 10 and indeed younger are being introduced to a world that they're not ready for by being given devices, by being given access to social media at too early an age. So that safety net of the family that they need for that stage, they're losing earlier.
Yeah, because, you know, I hear it spoken about even on the level. At that time, you're really struggling to find where you fit in. If you're lucky, you have your core group of mates, but you're starting to notice whether it's the opposite sex, whether it's wanting to leave the family a bit more and hang out on street corners or wherever it is. And sometimes you're allowed to do that, sometimes you're not. But now with social media, you know what parties you're missing out on. You know what the cool person in your class is doing 24/7 instead of being able to come home to your safe place in the home and switch off from all of that.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. It's at that absolute stage of development where the need to fit in is huge. The need to have friends is huge. And yeah, it's being compounded by, it's also being compounded by the social comparative online. So they're constantly comparing themselves with others. This need for likes and this need to be recognised and validated online by people who, as you say, aren't their friends. I always work with young people and their parents to get them to identify values in friends. So who makes, I even said to my own children the other day, "What? Tell me about the friends that make you feel good." And this is where I think you mentioned this earlier on. In terms of what we can be doing, we need to start addressing the emotion side of it. And I know people out there will be going, oh God, here we go, the emotion side of it. I'm reading a book at the moment, The Whole Brain Child, and I really recommend it to people with younger children. It's getting us back into thinking that it's not as simple as just a right brain and a left brain. We have to integrate the two.
So what does that mean? What are the differences between the two sides?
Well, the left brain is a very logical, list-orientated person, very organised, very structured. But emotions are normal. Emotions are an absolutely crucial part of each and every one of us. We all have them. We all have to address them. I read a gorgeous line recently that said, I feel everything, so I never get depressed. And I think there's such value in that because if we blank out all our emotions, if we avoid them, if we go into withdrawal, if we fight flight, if we completely disengage from our emotions and become a very logical person, that's not the healthy picture. That's not the healthy whole brain.
So like this all sounds great and everyone's like, yeah, I'm on board with this. I totally understand this. I totally want to help my kids. But when families are busy working and everyone else in the class has a smartphone and the kids are saying, I want to be online, where do you bring this in? And every time you try and talk to your 13-year-old, they're slamming the door in your face and saying, leave me alone. Is it harder? Is it easy in the theory, but in the practice, it's difficult?
I think you need to practice it. I do think it's because it's a new habit. Like even I was watching something. I know I'm full of references to watching and reading and listening, but I was watching something during the week where somebody was handed a tiny baby and the baby was crying, as they do. And she looked at it and said, what's wrong? And there is a classic example of where we need to change our language. We're always going, what's wrong? It's always that kind of, let's look for the problem in order to fix it. But when a young person is caught up in an emotional snowstorm, for want of a better phrase, when their head is absolutely full of words they can't really even understand, frustration, anger, sadness, things are overwhelming. We need to tune into that because they can't problem solve stuff. They can't make anything logical. They can't find the sense in anything until we tune into how they're feeling. So yeah, as parents, we do have to change our language.
To what? What
I see
way?
I see you're feeling angry. Please don't kick that door. I see you're feeling angry. Why don't you just tell me, Mom, I'm really angry. We have to teach our kids what words match what feeling. Because then they're not so scary. And we also have to teach kids that this moment passes. I think there's an overprotectiveness with parents at the moment. I think we don't, of course we don't want to see our children hurt. Of course we don't want to see our children sad. Of course we want to give our children the best we can give them. But actually by doing a lot of this, we're not serving them a great purpose. We're not allowing them to sit with an uncomfortable feeling and realise it will pass. So if they storm up to their rooms and they slam the door, let them. Give them that bit of space. I'm here when you need me. I see you're sad. I see you're angry. I'm here when you need me.
Because it is very different in this generation to how we were parented. And thank God, you know, that has happened. Yeah. Because again, the generation before that, children were seen and not heard. And, you know, in our generation, when I was a kid, you know, there was the clip around the ear and there was corporal punishment and there was a hierarchy of you must respect the parents. It's very different now. It's all about, you know, respecting the feelings of the child. Do you think that's muddling things, though, a little bit for people because they struggle with the new parenting and parenting very differently, as I say, to how they were parented and what the right thing to do is? That if you overcosset your kid, it can be a bad thing.
Mm. I just think we have to connect it. I just think parents have to get better at connecting it. I think we rush into fixing something for our child because we don't want to see them going through hurt. But then when they reach their teenage years and they go through a relationship breakdown or an exam fail, they haven't developed the skills to deal with that situation. So I don't think we're asking for a huge shift here. We're just asking for maybe better language, better communication between you and your child where you tune into how they're feeling. Instead of immediately, what's wrong? It's okay, we'll fix it. Let them figure that out. Give them the words for it, but let them figure it out. I think we've almost gone the other way. We were talking about this at a work thing during the week in terms of respecting the adults. And now what's happening, the gorgeous old phrase, it takes a community to raise a village. If you now talk to somebody else's child in the playground about how they're behaving, or excuse me, mind that little child over there, you know, oh, you need to be careful. You look behind you in case the parent's going to give out to you. So children are seeing that. And children are also seeing parents now going into schools saying, what do you mean my child got that? That's your fault. That's you. So the children need to start taking the responsibility. I know there's loads of different factors to this, but the children need to start taking responsibility for their work, their engagement with teachers, instead of parents jumping at teachers blaming. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And then at home, what we need to be doing is we need to be connecting the feelings that are going on for the kids. This is our biggest issue from a parental point of view, is tuning into how our kids are feeling. Not necessarily what they're doing. It's okay that they are feeling angry. All this stuff is okay.
So you have some seminars coming up where you're going to be meeting with parents and empowering them to make change, because even the most difficult situations can be changed, do you feel?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. And I think the earlier we address it, the better. I think sometimes with our teenagers, if they begin to feel these feelings of worry, I'm going to say anxiety, this sense of withdrawal, this feeling that the world is unsafe, the quicker we can get to that, the better. I'm doing a seminar on the 12th of November in Howth Yacht Club. And what the real purpose behind this is, because I find with every young person I'm working with, it's the same story. It's the same situation. It's either that sense of unsafety. I don't feel safe doing this. I have too many worries. I have anxiety. So how do we address it? At a really basic story. Really, I'm going to try and simplify it as best I can for parents. And the other thing that's coming to me a lot is this sense of, oh, he's overreacting. And I say we don't overreact. I say we react to an accumulation of things. So if your child is overreacting, that one thing hasn't bothered them. There's a myriad of things that have gone on throughout their day or their week that has accumulated in this moment. So it's to make sense of all of those situations to parents.
And with very simple tips. Well, if you want to find out more, you can go to superme.ie. From there, Jennifer Ryan, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we meet Trudy Hayes to hear the story behind her scars.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
So Trudy Hayes is the founder of the Raven app. It allows users to access beauty and hair treatments in their home. I myself have been the recipient of some great blow dries ahead of my various broadcasting endeavours at all hours of the morning. But it was designed and still serves people in hospital after Trudy herself spent years going in and out of hospital after she had kidney failure. Now, 12 years on, she recently bared all for the world famous photographer Brock Elbank for his Scars series. And underneath, she describes the story behind hers. And she joins me now. Hello, Trudy.
Hey, Claire.
So was that a big decision as to whether, I mean, you literally bared it all. We're talking naked, no hair, no makeup.
No hair, no makeup, no nails.
For that. It just shows you're in the know. But that's what he asked for.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so funny because he got in touch with me. I had written a little post online about my scar. And I must have hashtagged scars and he got in touch. And he said, I'd like to photograph you naked. And I wrote back, weirdo.
So, perfect. It wasn't, Great start.
Now I'm from the Tinder generation. But I looked back then on his stuff and I was like, oh my God, he's a world-renowned photographer. What am I doing? No, it wasn't a big decision. I'm older now. Probably years ago, he had asked me and I was a bit more insecure. But now I was like, yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Because you did have the biggest life lesson ever, didn't you? Because 12 years ago, you literally lost everything. What was going on in your life around that time?
So, well, in the years coming up to that, I had everything, if you know what I mean. I had, well, what I thought was everything. I was just about to be married, had a lovely house, we were getting a big extension on, had a great job, I was travelling all the time. Just a great life, just a really, really great life. And just all of a sudden, I just started getting these headaches. And I was travelling with L'Oreal and stuff at the time. And I was over in Fashion Week and I never took a day off in my life. And I said to the girls, I have to go home, I'm so sick. And I didn't think anything of them apart from them just being stressed, maybe related or tiredness or whatever. And I was
just
popping
burnout.
Paracetamol, and I got the plane on the way home and my dad, the pilot rang my dad to say I was rushed to intensive care. And I woke up, they told me I was going to have to start dialysis. I was on... Yeah, and from that day onward, it just everything changed. Everything just changed in my life. I wasn't able to work as much because I was on a machine for about 12 hours a day. So that meant less money. It meant that we were fighting at home all the time because of bills like coming in and out and stuff. And it was just it was a really hard time, you know. And it wasn't until the kind of end of that year that the recession kicked in and he lost his job that we were just... couldn't make it work anymore.
Yeah, because it's like, I mean, I know I'm using a very banal game to compare it, but it's like Buckaroo, isn't it? The more you pile on to something and when you can't get that time together and you can't get rid of the stress, sometimes you just buckle under the pressure as a couple.
Completely. It's not his fault either. I mean, it must have been very hard to look after somebody who's not feeling well. And for someone that was like, I was such a go-getter and like always... like up and at him, and then all of a sudden I was just crashed and burned and I just couldn't take it anymore. And then when we broke up, it was 4 months before our marriage, like we were going to get married within 4 months of that and I had to sell my wedding dress. But that's still a bit emotional for me actually, still kind of get a bit choked. So it was really, really hard. I sold everything. We sold a car, I sold clothes. It was like embarrassing at that time because as you remember, the Celtic Tiger times where like everybody was splashing the cash everywhere.
Yeah, and I mean, you had a really high powered job. You were working as a hairdresser at the top of your game. So you had money, you were working around that kind of stuff. Yeah. So obviously you were spending
cool
like
that time not to have money, you know. It wasn't like, it was a really tough lesson to learn. But it's not until you lose everything that you realise you don't really need anything.
I heard a podcast recently with Katie Piper. She was the girl who was attacked by, she had an acid attack from an ex. And she said the same as you, you know, that she woke up in a hospital and she lost everything. She couldn't pay her rent, obviously, because she was in hospital for so long. And all of her possessions were taken as evidence or sold on by the landlord. Yeah. So she's like, it's only when you lie there and literally have nothing that you realise you don't really need all of that stuff.
It's really bizarre because it's so... You know those years where you go through every Friday night, you're buying something to go out, or you're like, I mean, you really need that car, you really need to, and you're kind of keeping up with the Joneses when you're in your 20s and 30s. I don't know, it's just all of a sudden you feel like, oh, I mean, I hit rock bottom, like I had a nervous breakdown. It wasn't just an easy going into a little sad phase, it was bad.
Because you were going to need a transplant. That's what you were told. Because I think as well, when we're going around and we're looking on social media and measuring ourselves in crazy ways, we're not actually thinking about our insides and our organs and those sort of things. And you were forced to think about that.
Completely, yeah. Like you're always thinking of the, like, oh, look, this little bit of fat that's sticking out over your jeans. Or
a pimple on your chin.
Exactly. Or your hair's not sitting right. And then all of a sudden you're realising, Jesus, the inside of your body makes everything work. And you don't give it enough credit, and I really value my body now. Like, I really look after it, and I really understand, God, after everything I've been through and everything I've put myself through, it still works. I still wake up every morning, I can still breathe, I can still do everything that I need to do. And it's sad that it takes people a trauma or something like that for that to happen. But
yeah. That's where you were at. So what were they saying? I mean, what had happened in your body? Was it something that there was a family history of?
Not at all. I think I just crashed and burned. I'd say I was working too hard. I was probably dehydrated all the time. I had that lifestyle as any hairdresser would. As you know, you're working hard, you're playing hard, you're out all the time.
You're not taking lunches. You kind of just take head after head after head, don't
just
you?
Not looking after yourself the way you should, you know? And I'd say, yeah.
So your first attempt at a transplant was with your
dad. Yeah, my dad.
And yeah. I mean, it must have been a lot for them to take on as well, not just the physical side of the transplant, but to see you so unwell.
Any illness is a family issue, I think. It's not just about the person. Like, and that's it really takes away from your own selfishness when you see your family under pressure as well for you. And it took a long time for me to take the position of letting my dad donate to me. And I'm sure it took him no time, actually. He said straight away that he would do it. But it is a big deal to make someone else sick to make you better.
Yeah.
So it was a rough ride for the whole family.
And what had you been like up to that in your head space? What was your mindset going through it all?
Not great, because I was still in and out of the hospital. I had moved back home because we had split up. I was in the process of selling off all my furniture and bits and pieces that I had to make any bit of scrap of money that I have. And that's not talked about enough either, you know, the financial side of being ill.
Yeah.
Because it can really take a mental effect on your whole being. You're like, so it was a rough ride, I think, that whole time.
So you obviously pinned a lot of hope on this transplant with your dad, that this was going to be the turning point. And when it wasn't, it pushed you down even further and you had a full nervous breakdown.
Completely. Within a year, my body just started to reject it. I was just getting sick, and I was vomiting all the time. And they brought me in, they had the discussion with me, they were going to take it out. And I said no, as if I had an option. I was just like, no, you're not. I wanted to keep it. It was the only thing I had left. I thought, like, this is it. I don't have anything left but this. And they just said to me, it's making you really ill. You have to take it out. So when I went in for that surgery, I just honestly didn't want to wake up from the surgery. When I came around, I was nearly disappointed because I just thought, what else do I have now?
How can I have the strength to keep going? So how did you find it?
It was funny. I was in hospital for a long time and I didn't get out of bed. They were really at me, you know, come on, get out of bed. But I was just so, like, down. It was about 3 weeks in and the doctors were coming around and they do these checks on you every day, and I was just being prodded and poked like a pin, and I would just, you know, move my arms around, like, whatever, do whatever you need to do to me. I forgot that I was kind of human. And the guy came in, he was like, he was a new young doctor, you know, and he checked my leg, they check your ankles and stuff, and he pulled up my trousers. I had like the most massive hairy legs ever, and just the look on his face when he saw, because he's just a young guy, like, he never saw hair in a woman before in his life. And it cracked me right up. And it just took me out of something. And straight away, I just rang my sister and I said, can you come in and shave my legs? And paint my nails and do whatever. And it wasn't until she came in and did that that I was like, oh my God, I forgot. I'm an actual person. I can get out of this. I can do what I need to do. It's just a simple act of pampering, or I don't know.
Yeah, a bit of self-care.
Self-care.
And I know we've talked about worrying about your weight or a pimple or the silly things.
Yeah.
Aren't important when it comes to being healthy and happy inside. But it's not frivolous to enjoy taking care of yourself and feeling good about your appearance. And beauty treatments can help that. And that's where you had the idea then for the Raven app.
Yeah, like complete. I said to my sister, is there anyone that, do you think one of the girls come in and do something for me when I'm in here? And we just couldn't get anyone. And I worked in a hair salon. Like, I just couldn't get anyone to do it as a, like a profession. There was no one doing call outs. And I just thought there's a real market for this coming in. Just even to wash someone's hair to make them feel like they've had a wash. And the nurses are amazing in all of the hospitals. I was in Beaumont, loved the nurses in Beaumont. And they do come in, they try and do their best, but they don't have much time.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting a little body wash or whatever. There's something lovely about having your hair washed.
And blow-dried.
And blow-dried, that you're like, I feel clean, I feel like a human.
Yeah. And when you're looking in the mirror, it just gives you that strength. So
of course.
Your service not only goes to hospitals, but there's hospices for people at the end of life, but also
completely.
New mums, people just after recovering from surgery, because all of that makes a massive difference.
People that are disabled, that can't get into the salon. We do a lot of trans guys and girls that are in transition that are too nervous to go into the salon. But not only that, like, we offer those services for complimentary, but we need obviously the other side of it to work in order to offer that complimentary, you know. So like the bulk of our work would be corporates and business women in the morning that just can't find the time, that are time poor and just need, you know, need their bits and pieces done before they go to work, or you know, mums at home that are breastfeeding and just like,
yeah. As I say, I've had you to my house in my kitchen many times, and you know, seeing your photo there with the scars, it really reminded me that we never really know what's going on in people's lives. You
completely.
Don't know who you're walking past on the street and what their backstory is. And that's how I felt when I saw your picture with your scars. How do you feel now looking at that 12 years on?
I feel like I hate my scars at first when I woke up and there was all staples everywhere, and they were much bigger obviously when you first get operated on, and the staple marks are still very much there, and even now they are. But I thought, God, my body's, you know, mutilated. But then as time has gone on, I just wear them as they're little stories now, and I'm very proud of them. They've got me through life, and I'm absolutely proud of my body. I feel like I love every lump and bump and every pimple and everything. I really appreciate everything that I have now.
And they remind you of how far you come and how far you have come. And I think we should point out that you did have a second transplant then with your mum.
God, yes, I did.
That worked.
Yeah.
In case she's listening. I mean, she's given you a kidney, for God's sake.
My poor mum. Yeah, my mom, believe it or not, it's unusual actually for families for the two parents to be a match. And my mum was 100% match. How lucky is that? She got tested and she was 100% match, and it was just perfect since then. I haven't had any problems.
Amazing. Well, I think you're an absolute inspiration. It's a beautiful, strong photo, and it just shows your beauty inside and out and your strength. And to come back from that is incredible. And it's a great business that is nationwide. So if it's something that you think you're interested in, do download the Raven app. And Trudy Hayes, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Claire.
So that's it from Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy. Elaine Power was on research, and Jojo Cardoza was on sound. Vincent Wall is up next. Have a great Sunday.